Hey everyone, Tony from Unwatchables here. To close out the final week of Pride Month, we're unlocking a recent Patreon exclusive bonus episode where me, Mark, and Seth discuss our favorite films that explore LGBT themes and feature LGBT characters. The bonus episodes give us opportunities to poke at the boundaries of the Unwatchables concept and to talk about movies we actually really love instead of just movies that gross us out. So if you enjoy the more casual approach to this episode's conversation, consider supporting Unwatchables on Patreon for access to more episodes like this one. You can find us at patreon.com/unwatchables. Happy Pride, and as always, thanks for listening.
All right, so yeah, this is the Unwatchables bonus Pride episode for Pride Month. We're going to talk about some gay movies, ones that we like, ones we don't like.
These movies identify as gay.
The state of the queer film. Because I tend to think, you know, about gay movies, you know, for many years, they kind of were Oscar bait ones where you would get someone who gets, you know, Oscar for playing a gay guy like Tom Hanks in Philadelphia or Leto in Dallas Buyers Club playing a trans person.
Right.
And yeah, so brave. Sean Penn in Milk. Like, it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, regardless of if they do a good job, sure, there is an element of that. Which, Sean Penn does a great job. He does an act. I love Milk. I'm a big fan of Milk.
He does, yeah. And I haven't seen Philadelphia, but I assume that Tom Hanks, you know, doesn't stink up the joint in it.
But sure, there's always a little bit of that feeling that you get at a Pride event where you see, like, the Huntington Bank, like, little desk over there.
Right, the ExxonMobil display.
Mm-hmm. Come on over. Come to the gay bank.
Right. The Halliburton stand where they're giving out rainbow tattoos.
Mm-hmm. It's like, maybe we don't want everyone to be our ally, actually. Maybe we want some enemies.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I don't necessarily think that, you know, gay roles can only be played by gay people. But I do see the reasoning behind, like, there should at least be more examples of it where we're a little bit, you know, the years have gone by and we're a little bit more advanced now where it's not just something that, you know, straight actors do to show off. And I think especially with trans characters, that's something that, you know, a lot of times these are the kind of roles that are most playable by actual trans people. And, you know, they don't have as many opportunities with other kinds of roles.
Oh yeah,
and there's so many great trans actors out there that there should be way more room for them.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think we're breaking ground. We're getting closer to stuff like that. It's definitely more encouraged, or at least there's more outrage when it doesn't happen, or like even with people of color or something. Like there's like the Aladdin, even like the Aladdin movie, like, as dumb as that movie was, there was at least like some uproar around the fact that it didn't actually, it was just like a lot of white people behind the camera or writing it or directing it and things like that. So I think that outrage is good.
Yeah, because you do have to make a conscious effort to kind of even the field a little bit because of where, how slanted it was before. And you don't have to get, you know, hysterical about it or anything. But I think there is a point to it, to bring drawing attention to it, or else it's just going to revert to the status quo of just, bunch of straight white guys doing everything.
Sure. Man, I feel like every time we do a bonus episode, which was once before this, I'm like very tired from being like out in the sun and running through the woods. Same thing happened this time. So I'm talking about as fast as I can talk right now, because I just had such a blissed out,
that's a good point,
little woodsy experience, and I was super hungover from Pride last night. First Canton Pride, Canton, Ohio. First Pride.
Yeah, that's
little tiny bit of progress.
That's a good point, Seth. We will find you a studio that doesn't require you to run barefoot through the woods to get to it.
I know. I'll this microphone is like all the way at the end of the studio room, and it's surrounded by trees, and I have to have a lovely, weird hippie time.
Seth's inside a giant tree trunk right now.
I am. I'm kumbayaing as we speak.
But as far as the Oscar bait movies, though, when I was trying to think of my favorite gay movies,
it's hard. There's so many.
Yeah. But some of them were ones like I am a fan of Brokeback Mountain, which is kind of I think the first one that comes to a lot of people's minds.
Oh, you know, I've never seen that.
Oh, really?
It's so silly. I've never seen it. I don't know what my problem is. Being a homophobe.
Well, there is a little bit of a, you know, prestige film aura about it. And there was a lot of back padding and stuff at the time. But there is something to be said, especially back in like, what was it? Yeah, 2005 when that came out about, you know, big movie stars using that platform to bring awareness to things. And I think that movie still meant a lot to people. And I can't take anything away from Heath Ledger's performance. He is so good in that movie. And so completely unable to express himself on any level that it doesn't necessarily have to be just, you know, the tragic gay romance movie. It's really about somebody who is so inhibited. They can like barely even verbalize what they feel ever.
I love that. Yeah. That there's more than just his, it's not just his sexuality that he can't express. It's like a lot of things, which is the truth for a lot of people.
Yeah, and part of the point of that is that these are supposed to be characters who are so, you know, masculine and tied into this world where they could easily pass their whole lives if they wanted to. And they basically try to. And, you know, that's an important part of the story. So that's I totally recommend that movie. And it's by Ang Lee, so it looks like beautiful. And he's told queer stories before.
Yeah, I'd say my mainstream pick as far as like ones that it would have been easy to cross your arms about and be like, I'm not seeing that. It's just a straight guy playing a gay guy to get an Oscar or something. A Single Man, that's a very special movie to me, which, you know, it did do very well when it came out and it was critically praised and everything. But I don't know. I find it to be one of the most touching movies I've ever seen. It is just such a good portrayal, gay or not gay, of loss and losing someone, whether through a romantic breakup or death, which is the case of the movie, which I think is such a gorgeous thing to behold. Tom Ford, the madman guy, and the fashion designers behind the camera and making everybody look so good and making his last day so beautiful. I just think it's a beautiful example of how wrapped up we are, like in relationships and in, whether just like the way we get attached to people in our lives. And that's like why the title is such a big deal in that. It's like A Single Man, is that he spends so much time brooding over this man and this loss. And he is just, you know, by the end, he does remember that like he and this man were just two examples of little tiny people in a very big world. And like throughout his last day, which, yeah, that's the whole thing. He's like debating on committing suicide after his boyfriend is killed in a car wreck. Throughout the day, he's just reminded of that there is a lot of beauty in the world and everything. And there is some things that are worth sticking around for and everything, even though like X and Y didn't turn out just how I wanted them to be. They're out of my control, which I think is a good thing to meditate on for anyone, especially queer people, because quite often things are so out of our control.
That's a perfect pick too, because just like you haven't seen Brokeback Mountain, I haven't seen A Single Man. But
oh my god, we got a swap date.
Yeah,
night.
That's a Colin Firth, right? In the
yes,
the lead role of that. Slays. Yeah, he's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, those are our prestige Oscar bait picks that are actually worth watching. I at the end of this, we're both going to reveal our favorite gay pride movie and then just one that we want to spotlight, you know, in particular to recommend to people. But one that I almost picked.
Structure.
Structure. One that I almost picked was Carol by Todd Haynes, which kind of...
hell yeah.
Kind of falls into that category because, you know, it's two great, you know, straight actors who are playing off each other, and it's another forbidden love kind of thing. This time, I think it's Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett.
Yes.
In the roles, and another beautiful, subtle, you know, wistful film by Todd Haynes, who's, you know, a fantastic director.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, I think that kind of falls in that category, but I think that's even a bit better than like Brokeback Mountain or some of the other ones that we talked about, which is, yeah, just a really beautiful movie. I haven't seen it in a little too long now. I got to revisit it again, but I remember
it's
loving
so
it.
It's so good to look at. It's just so pretty. And yeah, Cate Blanchett and Rooney are just like, man, they're just such beautiful human beings. I want to be them. I want to date them. Yeah, all of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though, is so many of these movies, when they think of the gay movie, it's like almost always about some kind of a doomed romance or a tragedy, you know, which there's plenty of great movies, you know, like that. But it's interesting to think about, you know, the different kinds of what can be a gay movie that's not just about them being, you know, repressed and or some terrible crime being committed against them.
Sure.
I think that... Pedro Almodovar has his whole like filmography. He's this Spanish director, I believe. Oh God, I really hope I don't got that. Don't have that wrong. Hang on, I want to make sure I have his national. No, he's Spanish. Yes, he is Spanish. Good. And he has made so many movies about queer people, gay people, transgender people, and they're these like really overheated melodramas that are a lot of fun. And like All About My Mother and Bad Education are the first ones that come to mind.
Uh-huh.
And that's just a great way to dive in and get your like soap opera melodrama, you know, hyper stylized fix. That's not, there's definitely tragedy in there, but it's so much about having fun and like twisty narratives. And it just seems like they has so many characters like that. It's not like he has one gay movie. They're just part of the ecosystem that he creates.
Yeah.
And he's made so many movies.
Yeah, there are a decent amount of movies that I can point to that do answer that question pretty well. And actually, like, some older movies in queer cinema that answer that whole, like, stereotype that gay stories are only about tragedy or death or breakup and things like that, or ennui, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but there is a lot of it. I would point to Totally Fucked Up by Greg Araki, who is definitely a part of that whole queer new wave, like later period queer new wave in like the late 90s, early 2000s. Some of his movies deal more with, like, you know, exploring AIDS directly and exploring, like, you know, homophobia and things like that. But Totally Fucked Up is interesting because it's just this cast of teenagers. And they're all queer, gay, lesbians. They're all like some form of this. And it almost feels like it's in this weird, like, borderline utopia or zone or something. Because they are, like, they're complaining a lot, like teenagers do, but they seem just, like, totally in their own, like, teenager world. It reminds me of, like, I don't know, like, Charlie Brown or, like, cartoons like that that I would look at, and there's just, like, no adults in it, it feels like. And it's just, like, gay kids, and there's not really a huge conflict surrounding any sort of, like, ideas of being, you know, attacked by the straight world or anyone like dying in any sort of awful way. They're just like these sort of like little vignettes. It kind of reminds me of maybe, you know, Linklater's Slacker or something in that way. That's a great one to point to for that. And Greg's work in particular is just like some of the best gay movies out there for me.
Yeah, he has so many I've heard of. I've only seen a couple, and Kaboom kind of sounds like the closest to what you're describing as far as the ones that I've seen, the few that I've seen, because that's just like a really absurd comedy, almost like sex comedy.
Mm-hmm.
That has like, that gets really wild in the end, and there's like an apocalypse happening. And yeah, I really like that. And then, of course, his most well-known film has to be Mysterious Skin, which is definitely a tough one, and, you know, pretty explicitly about like childhood abuse and things like that.
Yes, that one is, it was close to being my pick, my number one pick, but it's up there for me as far as queer-related movies are concerned. It's a really special movie to me. I just think there's something that you can only get from that movie in there. Just a strange atmosphere, very shoegazy, and very intense. Lots of there's pedophilia in it. There's and in very complicated, really intense sort of ways. But it's also interesting. It's a good example of something that's like, I don't know. It reflects life in the ways that the movie has those big themes and has horrible scenes involving those aspects of life in it, but it doesn't necessarily define the movie in the way that, like, I don't know, there's like more to it than just these like big horrible issues going on in it that I appreciate the movie for doing that.
Yeah, and that has kind of an interesting slant on it, where on one hand, you have Joseph Gordon-Levitt at his like youngest and most beautiful as this gay prostitute,
my boyfriend,
and and so he also has a, you know, this history of sexual abuse, and you kind of see him working through that. While at the same time, his friend, who has a similar past, has kind of turned it into this fantasy that he was abducted by aliens, and it's interesting to see how they. Both of those kind of tie in together and how they're both dealing with similar things. And there's tough stuff in it with Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, but there is a scene though where one of his clients is some guy who has some kind of a like skin disease or something.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly what it is. And from what I remember, it's like this really tender, you know, scene where he like, you know, cares for him and is, actually showing like the kind of thing where sex work can be a beautiful healing, you know, thing for the client.
Yes.
And that's so moving in that sequence, because it is, you know, this is somebody who has like a really kind of rough, disturbing, you know, condition or deformity or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think that can be a good pro sex work movie, long as you don't get too hung up on the, you know, the parts of it where he is getting, you know, assaulted by people or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's just the reality. Like it can go well. It can also not go well. Like so many things, but yeah, I love that movie. I love Greg Araki. That would be a great one for us to do a podcast on at some point. It's definitely unwatchable in a lot of ways. I talk about it in an episode of Cinematary, another podcast. They have like a whole section of episodes where they go through Greg Araki's work on that podcast, and I really recommend what they did with that.
Cool. Yeah, can't talk about recent queer cinema without talking about Greg Araki. Now, speaking of unwatchable, I know somebody that we talked to last night at Pride loved a particular movie that is held up as a kind of a queer touchstone and does not have any of the tragedy or the pathos about it, which is Pink Flamingos.
Oh yeah.
And because, you know, favorite. It definitely has this ethos behind it, which we've talked about on the episode, but, you know, in particular that you know, there's so much of the cast is queer or a drag queen, and John Waters himself is gay, and all of that kind of bleeds into this being a work of like defiant outsider art and queer communities coming together, even though the film is absolutely repulsive in every way and you shouldn't watch it.
Oh my God, Mark. I'm going to give you a wedgie one of these times. Naughty boy. No, it's fair. It's filthy. They would be delighted to hear you say that.
It's exactly the reaction they wanted.
So you're just giving them, you know, really you're being a good gay, giving them what they want, you know?
Yep. Yep.
You're a good gay.
If you were having like a conservative uncle, you were trying to open up to the gay scene, I wouldn't start with Pink Flamingos.
yeah. Mom, this is my life now. I think this will give you a window in.
Yeah, this is exactly what it's like. I live in the pink trailer. Yeah, so that's, I guess a lot of John Waters movies you could probably throw into that category. I'm a little more of a fan of Desperate Living, so we could maybe, that has, you know, a lot of lesbian characters in it. So maybe I would recommend that one first.
Well, I know Mark loves girls, so.
Oh, boy, I can't get enough of them.
Yeah, Mark and titties.
How did that sound?
Yeah, I think I'm convinced.
Yeah. I love to do sex with them.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about you, Mark. You and the ladies.
Tony? There's Tony right on cue.
He popped in.
Don't worry, we'll edit this. We'll edit this to make Mark sound like he knows what he's
talking about. You need to make his voice really like echoey and beefy.
Yeah. I love to do the sex.
With the tits. The sex with the titties.
You guys just keep tempting me to add stuff to our soundboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry about it. It'll just keep happening.
Well, you know, another older, you know, more flamboyant, fun one would be like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Which I only just saw like this year. I don't know what was wrong with me. I'm a bad little gay boy.
What?
I didn't.
We're going to drop like a record scratch sound effect.
I know.
In there
I don't know what
that.
I was doing.
And this one.
Yeah, my partner at the time was just finally like, we need to watch it. We need to watch it.
Yeah, it's a blast.
I had such a great time.
And if you ever can see it live, that's the way to do it, because it's several different productions I've gone to in the past where everyone's dressed up and they hand out, you know, spoons and toilet paper and people are shouting out responses to the lines and stuff. Like, that's how it's meant to be. It's a celebration.
Well, I think that was my thing that deterred me, was feeling like I like kept on wanting to go see it, but I was also too intimidated because I'm just like, I'm going to embarrass myself because I can't keep up with the fandom. I don't know the line. So you just put it off. I've run into other people that have said this because it's just like intense fandom. I imagine that's how it is with like Star Wars or something, if you didn't grow up with Star Wars or something. But I felt like I had to watch it at home first. And now I'm ready to, like, I want to go to a real Rocky Horror Night. I'm ready. I'm converted. I will dress up. I'll do whatever. I want to be Meatloaf for sure.
Yeah, Meatloaf would be a good one for you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone dressed up as the Meatloaf character at those shows.
Well, you know.
It's usually a lot of Tim Curry's, a lot of Little Nell's or the maid lady.
I'll send a trend.
Yeah, Tony always wears those fishnets when he goes to those.
Hot. Good job, Tony.
So, yeah.
They just work on me.
Mm-hmm. They work on the boys, I bet.
Yes. Any input here from the only straight person involved in this podcast? Wouldn't you think, Tony?
Yes.
As far as we know.
Give the straights a voice.
Look, Mark, I don't...
Let them speak.
I don't like labels, okay?
Oh, true.
Yeah, I'm straight so far. I just haven't met the right guy. That's how I prefer to characterize it. No, I'm going to lead the discussion for the Straight Pride episode that we'll be doing soon on the premium stream.
Thank you. For that. It's only fair.
Top five straight movies.
The straightest movies of all time. Count them down. I initially misunderstood the theme for today when Mark said we were talking about gay movies, so I was thinking about like Wild Wild West with Will Smith. That movie was fucking gay.
Oh my God.
Spanglish, gay as hell.
Great. Now Tony's going to get fired from this podcast.
Oh.
And we're going to have to find a new producer.
When I realized when you guys started talking earlier that Mark didn't mean movies that just were stupid, then I was like, okay. So I started trying to think off the top of my head. I have a couple recent ones that I did really like. One that is probably my favorite was was The Favorite, a recent one that I saw a number of times.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah, and I think I saw that with you, Mark, at least one of the times I saw it. But
yeah, the lesbian love triangle in I don't know, whatever, like period piece.
It was so enticing.
Yeah, gay queen movie, mm-hmm. but not, you know, like,
yeah,
a
there
totally
you go.
Different type of queen.
You know, and, yeah. I like that director a lot. I like Dogtooth. And I like Killing a Sacred Deer a lot.
Oh, I love that.
But I actually think, like, yeah. that might be my favorite movie of his. And he didn't write it.
Yorgos Lanthimos.
I think that's
heresy, but okay.
I don't know, man. I think he might be better with somebody else writing. And he's just left to be a director. I don't know.
Man, that's the gayest thing you've ever said.
Thank you.
Definition of the word.
Oh, yeah. No. So, as in... unintelligent and stupid and wrong.
Right. This screenplay for Killing of a Sacred Deer is so good. I want another, like, real Yorgos Lanthimos movie before he starts doing more work for hire. But
no, I still want those.
I see what you're saying.
He's just also a good director for hire, apparently. Yeah.
Surprisingly, yeah.
I'm blanking on the one that I really didn't like.
The Lobster?
Of his.
I'm not crazy about that either.
I didn't get through that.
That movie
I don't know
is
why.
Fucking gay.
Yeah. It's gay.
Yeah, I did. I don't know. Maybe I need to jump back into that one. But
if that was
did not like that one.
If that was his last movie, then I would be agreeing with Seth and being like, "All right, now go on." But he redeemed himself again with Sacred Deer. But yeah, whatever he does, I'm there. I'll see. He's an exciting director.
Yeah, I know we talked about having his movies be an episode on the podcast, possibly.
Yeah, gotta talk about Dogtooth at least.
One thing I was curious to look into for this episode was kind of like some of the history of queer cinema. And I was specifically looking for like interesting like pre-Hays Code stuff that might be worth talking about. And, you know, I don't know how many of these anybody has seen, but I guess like the first same-sex kiss ever depicted was in 1922, which was like a little later than I like expected it to be, but it was this DeMille movie called Manslaughter. Does anybody know anything about what that is?
Oh, no, it was a DeMille and it was gay.
Tell me that it was Charlton Heston who does the kiss, though.
Oh, that'd be excellent.
I will find that out. And then a lot of the writing I could find about this, not just on the Wikipedia article, History of Homosexuality in American Film, but in other places too, was about City Lights, which I kind of had to like start recounting in my head, like what in that could have been like suggestive at the time or something. And I guess there's some like weird implied stuff with that like drunk rich guy, if anyone can recall City Lights. Oh,
yeah.
Moment,
Chaplin? That's a Chaplin movie?
That's an interesting read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the tramp is definitely a little light on his toes.
Yeah, that is kind of the... No, yeah. That is a feel you get from that character. And
yeah, he's fey. He's always kind of like, you know, posing and making little like kissy faces. And
yeah, that era had, you know, that maybe more like flashy kind of femmy male lead before, like in the pre-war days, especially. Which is interesting to witness.
There's like a scene where he just like meets this guy at a party and goes home with him and like wakes up in his bed. And then later in the movie, they run into each other and he like gives him a kiss.
Ooh.
And, you know, all stuff that's being played for like, you know, for Chaplin type laughs. But it's kind of interesting. But interestingly, it seems like the Hays Code actually kind of forced a lot of like Hollywood people to stop doing like just the stereotypes and having like, you know, the sissy or the pansy character or whatever, because it would, you know, potentially skirt some of the Hays Code no-nos. But that, I guess some people think that it actually led to there being like more nuanced or like subtle depictions of gay characters after that. But
interesting.
Yeah. Cause there'd always be characters who were kind of the coded gay guy. They're like the fae servant or, you know, comic relief or something where they would never come out and say it, or like the flamboyant theater director or something where it would all, everyone was just, even everyone in the audience was in on it, and everybody was, you know, kind of recognizing these were not characters who had, you know, lady friends around and stuff, but they could be, you know, funny and charming, and maybe that was a way that kind of made them palatable. I don't know.
Interesting.
But very much like coded stuff where they couldn't come out and say anything about it, but it was just understood by everyone.
And then by like the late 40s and 50s, it was like, that's not even possible. It's not even like, it couldn't even be in a movie. You know, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, I would be hard-pressed to say like the earliest film that specifically, explicitly was about gay characters. I wish that I know there's one from like the early 60s called The Children's Hour, which it's more about these two women who are like accused of having an inappropriate relationship. I haven't seen the movie, so I'm not totally sure if how much it's supposed to be, you know, completely that if whether they are actually supposed to be gay or not, or whether they kind of keep that under wraps. It has Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine in it.
That's interesting.
And again, I'm kind of speaking out of my ass here because I haven't seen the movie, but that does come up a lot as far as
like a talking asshole
dealing with that. Yeah, singing. I try to
sing in your song.
To sing out of it if I can. Pink Flamingos reference, everyone.
Parentheses. Thank you. Thank you for holding the audience's hand.
But I feel like maybe the 70s and 80s were probably where things got more explicit like that. Or more mainstream, like one of the movies I thought about was The Birdcage with Nathan Lane and Robin Williams playing a gay couple.
Yes.
And it's this like wacky farce comedy, which I think is really funny and good.
Mm-hmm. Super
funny. And Nathan Lane's actually gay, so that helps.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a fun one. That's not about, you know, tragedy. It's just a couple of guys having a good time.
Couple of fellas.
Yeah.
And you got some weird ones too. There's like a definitely a big history of like art movies that are very openly queer. If anything, that's where you looked by the like 1960s, 70s, or you know, sometimes in the 50s with Kenneth Anger. Kenneth Anger is like his first film. I forget when it came. It was like, is it early 50s? Maybe even like late 40s. And it's just like from another world. It's like not only like totally opaque and strange and like a dream that he had made into a film, it's very overtly gay, like gay sailors. And you just can't believe what you're seeing. And it's just like someone who is just like totally unafraid and unapologetic making this film. It's exciting to see. There's also films like Pink Narcissus. It's a early example of just like, it's sort of in line with Carell, which is a Fassbender movie, and a tradition of like these sort of gay fantasies or something. They're like more like gay dreams, which of course, like, I don't know, that appeals to the queer experience, especially back then that things were so closeted that the idea of these, like it could only be a fantasy for some people, which yeah, Pink Narcissus is just like this almost Grecian weird dream world that this boy is just lounging in. And Carell is really interesting as like, because Fassbender himself was like a big deal director. He did a ton of movies, and he also had like sort of a like bisexual tendencies and things like that. Carell is like this whole like gay sailor thing. The poster is amazing. Even if you don't watch the movie, just look at the poster on Google, and it's just like this lighthouse that looks like a penis, and it's wonderful. And there's a bunch of these just like in the movie, and it also feels like this, like, yeah, it's like this fantasy world or something for gay men to live in, which always appealed to me because that's how my sort of first awakenings to that world was. It felt like an alternate world, and quite often it is. It's you know, very much like they talk about alternative lifestyle. It's almost feels science fiction like, that it is just like turn a corner and it's a whole new world for people to enter.
Yeah, Fassbender is a great person to bring up because a lot of like you said, he has a ton of movies, and there's a usually the queerness of them are kind of more undercurrents. Although the Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, I think, is explicitly has like a female relationship going on, and that and then the director himself, you know, was there's this Moroccan actor who's in a lot of his movies that in most famously in Ali Fear Eats the Soul, which is like a kind of a retelling of All That Heaven Allows, the Douglas Sirk movie, except it's between this black Moroccan guy and this really old lady played by Bridget Mira. And Fassbinder had a relationship. He was like a lover of the Moroccan actor. His name's like El Hedi Ben Salem. I don't want to totally mess it up, but it's just knowing that they were in this relationship together. You can watch this movie where he is in this forbidden romance with this old dumpy lady as, you know, being about a transgressive, you know, kind of gay relationship, even though that's not literally what you're seeing. And yeah, that stuff is cool, where there's actually some cool gay movies that aren't necessarily about actual gay people.
I gotta see that Petra one. The guy who got glitter all over me last night, he loves that movie. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, well, Tony, when Tony brought up The Favorite, that made me think of another recent one, which was The Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is another, like, period piece.
I gotta see that.
Yeah, where this... artist is brought in to do a painting of this noble girl so that they can send the painting to her prospective husband, you know, so he can approve of her and then take her away. And they deliberately draw out the process of her doing this painting so that they could just spend more time with each other as they're like falling in love instead of sending it away for her to be taken and married off. And yeah, now that I think of it, there's been a lot of movies like that lately.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably on both our lists. I know we both love it. Talking about lesbian movies that came out recently, The Duke of Burgundy. Wow, what a gorgeous movie.
Oh my God, how did I not
absolutely
think about that?
Incredible. Yeah, I don't know how I didn't either. I thought of The Favorite right away, but I absolutely love that movie. I've seen that a bunch of times now too. Yeah. Awesome,
oh, Seth,
awesome
that movie would have been my number one pick if I just would have thought about it, and I'm not going to retroactively go back now.
I almost didn't bring it up because I wondered if it was your number one pick. But it still can be, Mark. It still can be.
Okay, well, technically, it definitely would be.
Yeah.
But it's just, I so think of that movie in terms of it being like about BDSM and role-playing and fulfilling your lover's fantasies.
I don't know. I never know how to describe it to people because... As much as I'm not, I hate being like this whole like, oh, spoiler. I don't want to spoil things, but like, I don't know how to describe it in like a way that like entices someone without spoiling some of what the fun is, which is like you are thrust into this bizarre relationship / scenario situation that encompasses an entire town. That you're just trying to figure out constantly, like, what is going on? And it's so exciting.
That's, you know, and that's why I think it didn't occur to me is because the gender is never an issue in that movie. It's a matter of fact, I believe there's not a single male actor in the whole film. And it's like they live in this world where, you know, at their jobs, in the town, everyone is a woman. And these two are, you know, in a relationship that's very much a, you know, role-playing thing where one is always, you know, locking up the other in a chest or you know, doing water sports with each other, like living out, just acting out these fantasies, but it gets into the mundane little, you know, ways, like the practicalities of, okay, now I got to get into the school uniform and I need something I can read while they're locked away in the box to pass the time. And there's, it's just like these, you know, these banal things that we do to have relationships with people and to excite their fantasies is kind of the price of admission. And it really becomes like this deep film about love and, you know, how much you have to drink a lot of water to be able to do water sports.
You do. You gotta do some work to pleasure someone.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Seth. God bless.
Oh, yeah. Gorgeous movie.
Yeah. And I know before we get to our favorites, there were just some other ones that I was considering I want to bring up that are really fun, like Bound by the Wachowskis.
Oh, yeah. The Matrix.
Which is kind of funny because, yeah. And it's funny because when that movie came out and, you know, they was basically being accused of these two, you know, male geek filmmakers fantasizing about this lesbian relationship between Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly. Come on. Anyways. Yeah. And now that both of them have come out as trans women, that puts a whole different spin onto it as far as those criticisms have not aged well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really fun, you know, crime caper, you know, lesbian flick.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, so is The Handmaiden from not too many years ago.
Oh, I don't know that one either.
I don't know. I want to say that's Park Chan-wook.
Oh.
Who did that? You've seen that, Tony.
Yeah, that was really good too, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, that's who it is. The director of Old Boy.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see that
and,
one.
And another really good one.
I would... I'd be remiss if I didn't bring it up, and I am having a hard time because this is like down. I feel like we're both getting down to like ones that are just like some days they are my favorite, sometimes they are. But I would say Weekend's a special movie to me. I forget the director, but it's a British movie from 2006 or 8 or something around then. And it's just very naturalistic. Depiction, one of the boys they meet, and one of the boys is very like, you know, just doesn't believe in love and is promiscuous and stuff, and the other boy is like, we see him slowly like, oh yeah I don't love, I don't do that, yeah, no, and but slowly he starts to bring it up more and more. It's just like, but like, this is good. Like, what if, you know, that like a very like very real concern in romantic relationships or just like think like casual relationships, where like, where do we draw the line? When is it time to just like say, like, I mean, are we ignoring what's really going on here? That we're having like a real connection and it's not just sex, right? And it does it really well. It escapes the feeling of being like some kind of romantic comedy or something. It feels very realistic. It's a good one.
I've read a lot about that movie and haven't gotten around to watching it. So I'm glad to hear you like it. Maybe I'll finally check it out now.
Yeah, I recommend.
I wanted to give a shout out to one more Oscar bait movie of recent years. But it's a pretty good, you know, it's a pretty good gay movie for the normies out there, which is Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, normies. And it's Merchant and, Ivory too, which I just watched. Morris,
you're right.
Another good queer movie.
That's on my watch list too. Mm-hmm. That seemed like it's going to be a little sad.
Oh, yes. It's Hugh Grant.
What it seemed like.
Just being a sad gay and you're just begging Hugh Grant, like, just suck a penis. It's okay, Hugh, do it. But... oh, spoiler, it doesn't exactly turn out that way.
Oh, damn.
Harsh.
That's too bad.
But
well, it does turn out that way in Call Me By Your
it
Name.
It sure do.
And I don't know. That's a kind of a good argument for let's still have our occasional movie where good straight actors just have to make out with each other. And sorry, I enjoy seeing
because
that.
Because we want them to. Yes. It's the only way we'll get it to happen.
I think gay people can enjoy that. I'm happy to see Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal roll around in the hay. Happy to see Timothée Chalamet, I mean, do anything, but TMI there.
Mm-hmm. If only we could just hire Jared Leto to like quit doing all this stupid vampire shit and just make out with some some hot boy for us on screen, you know? That's what I'm waiting
for.
Him
and Timothy need to pair up for sure.
Sure, whatever. Next Dune movie.
Speaking of straight dudes making out in movies, there's one that I found in my research that's a somewhat recent-ish one.
His research.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tony. How long have you been doing this research?
This is from months ago, but Mark only brought up doing this episode a couple days ago. So this is an article I found on the Huffington Post called "A Queer Reading of Dude Where's My Car on Its 15th Anniversary." You guys
Whoa,
should check out.
I'm so in.
Wow.
But it goes into detail about the Ashton Kutcher, Sean William Scott making out in the car scene, and really long article, probably way longer than that scene really deserves to be.
I love stuff like that. It's just like an entire book on fucking some tiny little scene and meet the parents.
Yeah, dude, where is their car?
Where is
really,
it?
In the end.
But we keep on derailing you. Do you want to say more about the Call Me By Your Names?
Oh, not really. I mean, I don't think it's a great movie, but it's really sweet and tender. And I like that it kind of turns out that Timothy Chalamet's dad in the movie, played by the great Michael Stuhlbarg, has kind of intentionally been setting him up with this student or person that he knows that he can trust to kind of take him out into the gay world and out of his shell.
It's kind of the best part of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, that scene is, I think, really beautiful. And there was, you know, talk at the time about how he is supposed to be, like, what, 16 in the movie or something? So, like, he is technically, you know, a minor with this older guy. And, well, if this was a guy and a girl, that'd be total, you know, imagine how people would react to that.
But it's not. That's like I don't know.
Exactly.
That's my argument about it. Like, there is something to that socially. Like, mm-hmm. Sure, it's a gray area. And it's in some ways and in a lot of situations, it's a, you'd say no. Like, but from, you know, what you see in the story, it's just like, this is pretty typical situation. That's the big overarching aspect of that movie, is the like typical nature of the situation, that it is just, you're gonna have, like, you know, you might have your first fling with someone that you're just not supposed to have that fling with, but regardless, you know, it's your first fling, so it's going to end, you know, and you're in tears, right?
And that movie takes place in the early 80s, which was a much less safe time to be out and openly gay. And it would be a lot easier to end up in some seedy club somewhere or bathhouse or all of that stereotypical kind of stuff where you have someone who is a little older and more experienced and is really an actually responsible gay person. They actually could, I think, do a lot of good for somebody who was in that vulnerable situation. And of course, that is going, I mean, the way that he's kind of, you know, handpicked by his dad is, you know, what makes him this trustworthy person. Like, he knew that he would be able to be trusted with his son, basically.
Mm.
And yeah, so it does make a difference with the time period and with the circumstances, and that it is a gay relationship, and that he does handle it in a responsible way. And Dan Savage, the gay advice columnist, has this thing called the campground rule, which is basically his advice to someone who is older, not necessarily who wants to date a minor, but somebody where there's a big age difference, say someone's like 18 and, you know, someone is in their 30s or 40s, that the campsite rule is to leave it in better condition than when you came to it.
Yep. That's a good one. Adam knows.
Out,
I love Adam.
Yeah. They come into, as long as they come out of it, you know, better and wiser and protected. And it may not end up being a long-lasting relationship, but good can come of it as long as you're, you know, doing it right.
I'm sorry. I swear it's the last one I will add, but I have to talk about it before we get to number ones.
Go for it, because I got one more, too.
Okay, fine. I'll show you mine if
you
show me yours.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Maybe it'll be the same one. That'll be so cute. Let's,
dude, where's your car?
Yes.
Yeah, see if it is.
One, two, three, four, say it. No. Stranger by the Lake.
Oh, good one.
I just adore it. It's like a slow atmospheric gay version of like a later day Hitchcock movie. I really love it. It's French, and it's this lake that these guys all come to and swim naked.
It's like a gay hookup.
Yeah, they cruise and they hook up and place. Everything.
Yeah.
But it has this very, I don't know, there's not a lot of music. It's really quiet. Lots of long takes. A lot of conversations that just take place with no cutting and no close-ups. And the first part is just like very calming, relaxing. Just this guy going to the lake and getting naked and flirting a little bit and just swimming. Like just swimming and meets an older guy there who's a little like, you know, off to the side and a little mysterious. And slowly you realize that this movie is turning into a sort of murder mystery that also has this, you know, it's like he gets involved with the person who's in like doing the murders, like knowingly. And he's kind of grappling with it, kind of being irresponsible with it. It's very romantic, very exciting, and some of the best, like, most beautiful and sexy gay sex scenes are in this movie. Very explicit sex scenes.
Very explicit.
Which we just, like, don't get, like, which we talked about, Call Me By Your Name, which, you know, a lot has been said about just, like, how that has the most typical, like, they start making out on the bed and... Classic, the camera pans to the window.
The camera glides
we don't get to see
away.
Anything at all. And like, yeah, when like you, it's really still like such a rare occurrence that you see gay thrusting or any sort of real gay act in a movie.
Stuff looks unsimulated in that movie,
yes.
too. At least some shots definitely.
Some
are.
Of the emphasis on shots, yes. Absolutely. Which, yeah, that's always the thing of frustration for me with modern movies. It's just like, apparently, they make such a big deal and try and be inclusive and try to have, like, gay stories and gay characters and stuff. But when it comes to, like, them actually doing gay shit, it's, like, very not okay. It seems, like, very rare for us to actually get, like, a real dick shot, even.
I call that the Scarface shot. There's the remake of Scarface, the Brian De Palma version, there's a scene where this guy's about to get killed with a chainsaw in a bathtub, and the camera just starts to drift away before it happens, and it drifts outside the window and outside, so all you can do is hear the chainsaw murder happening. Like, it's just too awful to see.
Right.
And that's what, that's the Scarface shot is what they do in Call Me By Your Name, where they're like, okay, let's, what's going on over here? Hey, look, it's a window.
I don't even get to hear that boning though, you know?
that's funny. And actually, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because the guy who made Stranger in the Lake, I probably won't remember his name or even know how to say it if I did, but he followed that up with this movie called Staying Vertical that I actually like even more.
Ooh.
And it's not just a gay movie. It's like, it follows this guy who hooks up with some random girl and she gets pregnant and somehow he ends up with the baby and she disappears, I think. It's been a while since I've seen it. Basically, he keeps going along the countryside, like looking for her, and any person that he runs into, he ends up having sex with. So Whoa. Sometimes it's a woman, sometimes it's a guy, sometimes it's like an old farmer man. And it's almost like a absurdist where no matter who he runs into, it'll like fade in the next morning with them in bed together,
no
matter how ridiculous the pairing is. And yeah, that's a good like semi-queer movie. It's definitely a fluid one.
Mm-hmm. Well, your turn.
Okay. Well, this is just one that came to mind because I've seen it many times, which falls under the whole like gay tragedy thing big time. But Ooh. I think that Boys Don't Cry is actually quite a good movie.
Never seen it. Yeah. I've always been afraid because it just seems like such an undertaking.
It is. And, you know, there's joy and romance in it, mm-hmm. but it is also gut-wrenching by the end, because, you know, it's about a real life transgender man, basically, but he was basically fooling a lot of these people who didn't know the truth, and does find true love with a character played by Chloe Sevigny, who it kind of goes unspoken between them that he's transgender, but there is a sense that he's being accepted, but unfortunately these other people, like family members who are around, end up, this is based on a real person, a real crime of somebody who was, this person who was murdered. And so you know that going in with this being a true story, but Hilary Swank is phenomenal as the main character. I think Brandon Tina is the name.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's definitely a tough one, and maybe a little bit too much of a just straightforward, you know, crime tragedy happening, but lots of good stuff on the way there.
Again, probably a good one for the podcast.
Could be. All right, so do you, Seth, want to say your favorite gay movie first and then do the one you want to spotlight, or vice versa? What do you want to
Well, I guess we've been greedy with our... We've been spotlighting the whole time a little bit, but I guess I'll start with just to shake it up. I'll start with my favorite one.
All right.
And it's kind of boring because I talked about it in the last bonus episode, because you asked me what is one of my favorite movies. And
so 2001 A Space Odyssey is what you're about to say.
Yep. It's gay as hell. No. My interchangeable favorites are always 2001 A Space Odyssey and My Own Private Idaho. There's just something very formative about Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho. When I saw that, the way River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves interact and have this sort of best friends in love but can't get there, and there's like typical kind of tragedy and unrequited aspects to it. I don't know. That just really rings true for any young gay, any old gay, whatever. They're like any romantic person, you can really relate to that. I don't know. I just...
And two other beautiful young movie star, just straight actors. Yeah. People forget about Keanu Reeves, but he was no joke back in the day.
Yeah. Gus picking up his little dolls and making them kiss, basically. Because why not when you have that kind of power in Hollywood as a gay? But I always love it. I really relate to it in that sort of way that it expresses queerness. I never got to see movies like that up to that point when I saw it in high school, where it's not overtly queer necessarily in its depictions. Like River Phoenix and Keanu are like doing gay shit, and River is in love with Keanu, but I just felt like when I thought of gay people up to that point, it was just like, well, they're wearing bright colors and they have a certain way of speaking, and they, you know, they do this and they do that, and this Rivers does not fit a lot of the generic gay stereotypes. In a lot of ways, he's just a guy, you know, like any other guy. Which I don't know, I kind of appreciated that and saw that in the movie. And Keanu's also like this complicated, like he's kind of a man's man, but he's clearly like a twink kind of guy. And he's keeps on insisting that, like, no, I don't love men, but he keeps on turning these tricks on the street, even though he's brought up as a rich kid. Like, he keeps on sleeping with men for money, and you're like, what is this? Are you sure? What is, you know, kind of these like little questions. And similar to what I was saying about like Kenneth Anger and things, it has this queer aspect that is like queering the reality of the situation, in my opinion, that is really exciting for me, which is this it doesn't take place in the real world at a certain point. It goes, dips in and out, and then it goes into, all of a sudden, everybody's speaking in, like, Shakespeare verse, and it's very much just, like, yeah, like, it feels like adults playing dress-up or something all of a sudden, and it's a whole other dimension, a whole other reality, a whole other, like, secret world, kind of, which I think is very exciting in that movie to witness. I adore it.
Nice, yeah. That's what I figured would be your pick, and you were actually right about what you figured what my pick would have been, except that I forgot about it.
I know the...
Which would have been Duke of Burgundy, so thank you. You got to pick for both of us, really. The one that I wanted to highlight, which I wish I'd seen more recently than I have, but going from memory, is actually a movie called The Crying Game from 1992 by Neil Jordan. And this was a big deal and very controversial when it came out. It's kind of a strange story of this IRA member who is part of this group that kidnaps a British soldier played by Forrest Whitaker. And the first half of the movie is them kind of bonding and forming this relationship, even though one is the captive of the other. And at some point they get separated, and Forrest Whitaker makes the guy promise that he's going to go visit his girlfriend back in London or somewhere. And once he dies, that's kind of his penance, that he goes and seeks out this person. And this is really tricky territory, because I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it, because there's no way to talk about it without it. So spoilers for The Crying Game. But he meets this girlfriend of the guy who died, and they start to bond. And there is kind of a reveal later on that this is actually a transgender woman, but after they've already fallen in love. And there is kind of a twist moment, basically, you know, where he sees her naked, and that's like the big reveal. So what I think is interesting is that it risks being exploitative in that way, but actually turns out to be this really tender, moving kind of romance between these two people, almost unwittingly. And again, it was controversial at the time, but the gay actor who played the transgender woman, Jay Davidson, was nominated for an Oscar for his performance, and actually just gives this really heartbreaking the performance in the movie. And it's really great, and he just got out of acting afterwards, so it's like his one big thing that he did. So, you know, there's been criticisms of the movie, but there's also been celebrations of it actually taking this really tricky plot and turning it into something that's very empathetic and memorable. And I look forward to watching it again, because it's been a while, but I do think that it makes a pretty deft balancing act of a movie. And so check out The Crying Game.
I had never heard of it. Yeah.
I would be interested to see where you land. Yeah, it's actually ends up being this really great, like, romance.
So I guess if I had to highlight one last thing in a episode about queer movies and filmmakers, it would have to be The Kuchars, The Kuchar Brothers.
Oh, not heard of this. Educate me.
They were contemporaries of John Waters, more in the New York school, I guess. I'm not sure. There's a lot I don't know about them, but I don't know. I'm kind of obsessed with them a lot. They were in the 70s, 80s. They just made films throughout these time periods, and they're a very big deal in the world of lo-fi cinema, of just like these kind of just, again, I always use this term, adults playing dress up. That's kind of how it feels. It's just like these silly outfits and these silly premises and just no budgets. Once digital cameras became like a thing and camcorders, they were immediately like adopters of these. It's hard to find their work. Some of it's on YouTube, really grainy quality. But they like range from, they usually are obsessive about like old horror movies like Dracula and the Wolfman and stuff. But they bring in these very sexual, very queer elements to it. There's oftentimes like explicit sex or like weird sexual innuendos going on involving these like these elements like UFOs and Bigfoot and Dracula and all this stuff. And it's very fun and it's very silly. They were also big into, especially George, one of the brothers, was really big into diary filmmaking. He has this series called The Weather Diaries, which I think is maybe a little easier to find on YouTube, where he just would go to hotels and he would just monitor the weather. And he would just be like there for a week, just updating you on the weather. And you get to see what he does in this like Nowhereville town, mostly like in Tornado Alley, where there's like tornadoes and bad weather and stuff. But they're both weirdos. They're both big weirdos, like similar to John Waters, in that like the second he opens his mouth, you're like, who is this? There's no one on the planet like this. And George Cuchar and his brother are both like this, especially, yeah, George just has this, they have this weird, like, New York kind of accent. They talk like this. And it's like, it feels like a put on. They're like these very strange, they have this like messed up hair. Yeah, the Cuchars are well worth it. I think there's a documentary about them I've been wanting to see, that John Waters is featured in. But yeah, wonderful stuff. And definitely in the world of being weird, being queer, and creating a totally alternative world and saying fuck you to any sort of standard Hollywood idea of how to make a movie.
Nice. Something new to explore. Look at us enlightening each other.
Look at that. That's what we're here to do.
Digging out these little discoveries. That's what it's all about.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, God bless us, everyone.
Everyone. Well, the movie that I wanted to spotlight is probably another one that people haven't heard of, because it's very under the radar. It's called 4 Days in France from 2016. It is a French movie, and the debut film of Jérôme Rebaud. Still waiting for him to follow that up, I believe. And it's basically about this a gay guy who just disappears and splits from his boyfriend one morning, and it's not totally clear why, and he just kind of goes on this journey through the French countryside, and he's using Grindr as his guide. So he's always following the little beep, and the movie is all of his different encounters with all the different people that he meets along his way through Grindr. And he has, you know, lots of interesting interactions with people. While at the same time, his boyfriend is trying to find him. And he is also using Grindr to try and track him, like, from place to place. And he keeps, like, just ending up, you know, just behind him, like, meeting up with someone who just met up with his boyfriend. So I like to call this movie The Long and Grinding Road. Since
I was Grindr just looking what, at like, your Letterboxd review of thing. It, and there it was.
Yeah, sorry.
Classy.
And, yeah, and it, you know, it's very quirky, but there is a kind of mystery and melancholy to it, because you don't know what is going on in the main guy's mind. He's just this very polite, soft-spoken guy who's going through some kind of a crisis. And there is a funny moment late in the movie where his boyfriend finally recognizes where he is, because he recognizes his dick pic on Grindr. yeah, it's just a nice little movie, kind of funny, kind of quirky, but very evocative. And yeah, if you can find it anywhere, then that's something that I would definitely recommend. It looks like it's on Canopy. And yeah, I hadn't thought about the movie in a while, and then we were preparing to do this bonus episode. I was like, oh yeah, what was that movie that was all about Grindr leading this journey around?
Long and Grinding Road.
Check it out.
Long and grinding road.
So anything else anyone wanted to share? Tony, you can always decide to chime in.
You can come out of your closet.
Behind your rainbow closet.
I guess I already picked a favorite, whether it's the favorite or Seth also reminding me that the Duke of Burgundy existed. But I'll spotlight one for a second.
Do it.
Ooh.
If we have the time.
Do it.
I'm going to use this opportunity to spotlight probably like the single most boring option, one we briefly mentioned earlier. But I want to take this opportunity to talk directly to our straight male listeners, the dipshit straight guy. This is like 80% of our listeners, I would estimate, by the analytics I have access to.
Only you can translate to them.
It's true. Speak to your people.
Yeah, I don't want to lose them. So like, look, you're not homophobic. You're probably sitting on the couch wearing a pair of shorts that come to the correct spot on your knees that your wife bought you, and you groan when she makes you wear them to a cookout, but you secretly like how they compliment your body. You're not above drinking a White Claw, but only the lime ones, not any of the pink or purple ones.
There's just a little bit of skin between the where the shorts end and the socks end. Just
You're showing
only the tiniest.
That's you're showing that single stripe of leg. All the straight pride flag should just be like khaki and then like unkissed by the sun, like skin, and then like white sock. That should be those should be the three stripes of the straight pride flag. And you're scowling at this old house and talking about how annoying the hosts are, but you secretly like when it's on. And so there's an entry point here for you. And I think that movie is one that I really, really liked when I first saw it as a boy. And I haven't liked as much on the more recent viewings, but I still do think it's a really good movie. And when we already brought it up, it's obvious. It's Brokeback Mountain. Very, very...
That's the gay police are coming for Tony
on.
Right now.
Yeah.
Stop him.
It is a very touching story. Incredibly tragic. But it's, you know, it's Heath Ledger and it's Jake Gyllenhaal and they're tough cowboys. And if a cool cowboy can be gay, then, you know, you can wear shorts that fit you. And I think that's an inspiring thing for non-homophobic straight guys who are just a little that, you know, the guys that sit in that way where you cross your legs so the inside of your thighs never touch. Like, those are the guys that I'm talking to right now.
Hear Tony. So, listen to Tony.
I'm gonna rewatch Brokeback Mountain at some point in the near future.
Watch it with me. I need to see it.
Yeah, that's kind of fucked up that you've never seen that one.
It's pretty bigoted of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, the short story that it's based on is even better.
Oh.
There you go.
We totally recommend that. It's a quick read. And I think that makes it one of the better adaptations I can think of because they're both so good. But very very powerful story as well.
Right on.
Well, so
that's enough of that gay shit.
Yeah, there's our ungayables
embarrassing
episode for Pride Week month, whatever year.
Yeah, thanks for listening. We'll be returning to exclusively heterosexual content after this episode,
starting with a porno episode. Yeah. We'll be recording
a little next. Preview depending on when this one comes out. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, baby.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, baby, says Mark.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That was the gay Kool-Aid man.
Mm. He broke through your gay ass wall.
Oh yeah.
Mark has gone too far.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.